Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Bill O'Reilly comes on in the second half, talks about Killing the Mob, the latest in his Killing book series. Very interesting. So everything you want to know about the American mob and beyond shall be discussed. Enlightening stuff. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock. Tax season is scary enough. Now, the IRS is warning about ghost tax preparers who don't sign as the paid preparer and could be a red flag. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day, we put our info at risk on the internet. In an instant, cybercriminals could harm your finances and credit. Good thing there's LifeLock. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number, for sale on the dark web. If they detect your information has potentially been compromised, they'll send you an alert and you'll have access to a dedicated restoration specialist. Right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but you can keep what's yours, yours with LifeLock Identity Theft Protection. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year at LifeLock.com. Promo code Adam. That's LifeLock.com. Promo code Adam for 25% off.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Bill O'Reilly's Birthday Cocktail Party for September 10th. Let's see who's invited. American golfer and a refreshing drink, Arnold Palmer is here. In right field, Baseball Hall of Famer, Roger Maris. Vocalist from Three Dog Night, Danny Hutton. We say Feliz Compleanno to Jose Feliciano. Guitarist from Aerosmith, half of the Toxic Twins, Joe Perry. English actor Colin Firth is here. American hip-hop star Big Daddy Kane. Guy Ritchie. And German Shepherd, Rin Tin Tin. Bill O'Reilly is on the Adam Carolla Show.
Well, welcome back to Bill O'Reilly. The book, Killing the Mob, The Fight Against Organized Crime in America. It's available now on Amazon and probably many other places as well. And it's the 10th book in the multi-million-selling Killing series, which and I heard you this morning on my friend Dennis Prager's program, so I learned a lot from listening to that interview. So welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks, Carolla. I appreciate you having me on. I didn't know you could play the piano that well. Very impressed with that.
I always play along live. Sorry, kind of nut caught in my throat when I said that. So, Bill, I just had this thought. Maybe your legacy is the Killing series. Like, maybe when it's all said and done, that's how we remember Bill O'Reilly. Do you think that may happen?
I'd be flattered if that happens. You know, we have 18 million copies of the book in print, so I think it'll survive me. Most successful nonfiction book series in history of all time. So I would be very happy if people remembered me by that. Those are, I think, good books, entertaining. You learn a lot. You can trust the information. So why not, right?
I concur. I just think it's interesting in that we never really know what the legacy is. Like, you began doing the Killing books at what age?
Well, we did them. I was at the Fox News Channel, and then I had written a whole bunch of nonfiction books about politics. And I got a little tired of that, even though they were very successful. And I just said, yeah, I'm a former history teacher. Let me get into the history thing and try to use some of the techniques I had in a classroom in print. And boom, it worked. I mean, America's a great country.
Well, I talked to you when we spoke last about the American Indians, and I was very impressed by how much information you had at your fingertips. I was impressed listening to you on Prager this morning and how much info you had at your fingertips. I think at first blush, you think, oh, Bill O'Reilly's putting his name on this book and someone is writing it and he's just basically selling it. But you do know all the information. I mean, you take a deep dive into these subjects. So could you explain the process of coming up with a subject and then what's involved on your end?
Well, the late Don Imus used to go, "Oh, well, you don't write those books, you know." And if and you know me, if you follow me on television, and we're on every night on the No Spin News, a lot like what you do, the podcast, and then I'm on the radio. If you know my speech patterns and how blunt I am, then you can see it on the page. So the process is Martin Dugard, my co-author for all 10 books, he lives in Orange County, California, just south of you. He's a researcher, and I think the best in the world. He gathers the material based upon an outline that I send him. So we're going to write Killing the Mob. We want to start in the Depression years and go all the way through to contemporary society, Marty. And here's what we want to cover. Find out everything you can. And so he does, and he sends me, and then I'm the storyteller. I mold the story through the pages, so it isn't boring like most history books are. So it'll keep you up at night like Killing the Mob will. And anybody knows me knows that I'm not a, you know, one of these out front guys. I write everything I say and always have on television. No other anchorman I know of does that. So, you know, I understand why people may be skeptical, but they're not being smart in their skepticism, Carolla. How's that?
It's very good. In the Killing the Mob, one of the things I was interested in is, and we'll go in no particular order, but the mob as it pertained to the Muhammad Ali Sonny Liston fight, or then Cassius Clay Sonny Liston fight, you figured out that Sonny Liston was paid to take a dive in that fight, and the mob paid him.
Twice. And the way we got that was we went to his trainers, Liston's, what they call people. All right. So there have been rumors all around, and Sports Illustrated had done a big look at it. And they were good. That was a good series by Sports Illustrated. But we went further into the people who were in his camp, who were training him, and what their backgrounds were. So we were able to tell you exactly not only how Liston took the dive, and Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, he didn't know this. Right. In fact, when he walked back to his corner, he asked Bundini Brown, "Did I hit him? Did I hit him?"
Yeah.
That's how shocked he was that Liston went down. It was 6-1. The first fight Liston would win.
Yeah, Liston was a big favorite.
6-1 favorite.
Right.
So these mob guys, they made a bloody fortune laying the money late on Cassius Clay.
Right.
And then, you know, we trace Liston. You see where he was, what he was doing. It's not just enough to make the accusation, Adam. We really have to back it. And in every story in the book, we do.
Well, it kind of stands to reason in that it was always kind of labeled a flash knockout or something, like you couldn't really, we didn't have high def cameras and 5K or whatever, you know, we couldn't, you had to kind of trust the black and white footage back then. But Liston was a tough son of a bitch. I don't know everything about his career, but he didn't get knocked out a lot. And Ali wasn't Ernie Shavers. He wasn't a knockout machine. He was speed, finesse, you know, went the distance, you know, went into the later rounds. He knocked some guys out, but he didn't have that crazy one-shot power that some of the heavy-handed heavyweights had back in the day. So it doesn't even really make sense that he'd get flash knocked out that way.
Well, look. Sonny Liston was an unsavory character from the jump. And we even take you into his training camp. Instead of Ali trained hard, and Ali was a great athlete, very quick. Sonny had hookers all over the place in his training camp. I mean, that's how he was training. So, you know, when I write a book, I want to just put you there in the whole situation. So you're not looking at it from the outside in. You're there. And that's why I think why you like Killing Crazy Horse so much.
Yes.
When we talked last, because I put you right inside that tribe, right inside the battle of the Little Bighorn, where you're experiencing. And that's what we did in Killing the Mob.
Well, it's interesting. Earlier in the show, we were showing some footage that's making the rounds on the internet of a snowball fight from 120 years ago. And it's normally black and white and sped up, and it looks very old-timey. But they colorized it, and they slowed it down. And now it looks like it could have taken place last winter, you know. And it makes it much more palatable or digestible or something. You can identify with it. And, you know, when I grew up, I would read history books in class. It was old drawings and old people and this sort of very sterile accounting of what went on. You never felt like you were there. You know, you didn't feel like they were sort of human beings that you shared DNA with these people. But you do a masterful job of putting the people there and making it as if it's happening, you know, happened yesterday.
Yeah, we write in the present tense because I think history is thrilling myself. And if you read all of my history books, you'll know more about America than Joe Biden. Now, I don't know if that's the litmus test we want to put off, but you'll know a tremendous amount about your country. And that's why I do write the books. And Killing the Mob spans from the 1930s all the way up to today. And the reason we did that is because the mob started with Al Capone and Prohibition and the bank robbers, Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, in the 1930s. That's how this whole thing got underway. And the arc is to this day where organized crime still exists. It controls the narcotics traffic in America. That's the opioid crisis, the homeless crisis. All of that is responsible, the mob. And they're still there raking in the coin.
How did the Dillinger and the Babyface Nelson part of the bank robber part of the mob factor in? I mean, the Al Capone bootleg and the hooch and prohibition, that all makes sense. But how did the bank robbing stuff factor in?
Because during Prohibition, the press made these guys heroes because everybody hated the banks. The banks were foreclosing farms and houses. So these guys arose and they created such havoc in the middle of the country that the federal government, President Roosevelt, had to do something. So they formed the FBI under a young J. Edgar Hoover. That was the first federal law enforcement agency. The Secret Service was just responsible for guarding the president. So the FBI, that's how they got started to knock these guys out, the bank robbers. And the reason that we started there was because that tension between the federal government and the mob arose from those people. And the interesting part about Killing the Mob is I don't glamorize. It's not Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway. I tell you who the real Bonnie and Clyde were. And they were awful. And so was everybody in the book. There isn't one noble gangster in this book. They're all evil. Because Americans have that, you know that, Corolla. They have the Goodfellas and the Denzel Washington American Gangster and the Godfather trilogy. That's what they see when they hear mob in their mind. No, these were the worst of the worst, and they have done so much damage to this country.
Yeah, so they began in with Prohibition. They, interestingly enough, factored into World War II. Quite substantially. Can we talk about that?
Yep. Sure. And this is the shocker. And this is why Dugard is such a genius. So I wrote a book called Killing Patton. I thought I knew everything about General Patton. No. Because while we were researching Lucky Luciano, who was the first godfather, okay, we came across this incredible story where the U.S. government, FDR, Dwight Eisenhower, made a deal with the Sicilian mafia who had run that island for centuries to help Patton invade Europe through Sicily. Mm. And that was the quid. The quo was, if you help us, Sicilian mafia, we'll let you come to America after the war, which they did. And a flood of mob people from Palermo to New York City ignited the whole modern day mafia that we have now.
Interesting. Do you think?
I had no idea, by the way.
No.
I did not know that.
Obviously, we would have won the war anyway, or eventually. I don't, you know, it seemed like a pretty bad deal for America. Probably pretty good at the time.
But it saved a lot of lives.
Yeah.
It saved a lot of American lives, because what the mafia did was it practiced sabotage against the Germans, mm-hmm. who were occupying Sicily, and it gave Patton a way in.
Right.
So we didn't have any intel. So it saved a lot of American lives. Now, you can argue that the government didn't know how bad these people were, how the right. Sicilian mob was. And they just said, all right, we'll let a bunch of Italian guys with little hats in. Well, as soon as they got in, they took over all the rackets in New York and Philadelphia.
You also stated in your interview today with Prager that the mob is the single most destructive force in America ever. I mean, if you take a look at the sum total of the damage they've done and continue to do, I don't think most people think of them that way. We glamorize it, obviously, from the movies, but they're really a scourge. I mean,
the narcotics is just unbelievable. So in the beginning, Lucky Luciano and those guys, they were just gamblers, vice, prostitution, extortion, that kind of thing. Vito Genovese, the single most heinous American in the history of America, in my opinion, he brought in the heroin. All right. And that destroyed millions of lives to this day. And I'll tell your audience something, Carollo, right now. Joe Biden has no blanking clue about anything. His border policy has led in 100 days to hundreds of thousands of migrants, many of them children, coming to the United States. We all know that. But what's the unintended consequence of that? Well, all the Border Patrol and Homeland Security down on the Mexican border has to tend to those people, taking them away from drug interdiction. Well, the mob, which has an agreement with the Mexican cartel, is now the happiest crew in the world because heroin, fentanyl, meth, and cocaine is coming over the border in record numbers. Biden and his crew have no clue about this. They don't know it because of many, many reasons. But the big beneficiary of the horrible border policy instituted by President Biden is the mob. And I'm just telling your audience that right now. Homeless in California, that's the mob. 80% of them are addicted. Okay? They can't work. They can't pay a mortgage. Millions of people dying all over the place from fentanyl, that's organized crime. And so if you think that these guys are a bunch of Michael Corleones going to the opera, they're not.
What does the mob look like today in the United States?
Well, after Bobby Kennedy, and he's the hero of the book, attacked them in the early 1960s, and then Congress passed the RICO laws, which meant that even if you talked about importation of narcotics, you could be charged with a felony if they caught you on a tap. You didn't have to actually sell it. Conspiracy to sell was a felony. Well, they knocked down a lot of these mafia people. They went to prison for a long time. So the mob changed. They franchise out now. So in New York City, no, the big mobsters live in the suburbs with big homes. They don't see it. They don't touch it. But they allow the street gangs to deal on the neighborhoods, in the neighborhoods. And they pay tribute, what's called VIG, to these mobsters every month, suitcases full of money. That's how it works now. They've gotten out of the retail, they're in the wholesale. And the American organized crime has made a deal with the Mexican cartels. That's why you don't see Mexican cartels in the United States. They can't come here or they'll get whacked. They have to stay down there. They're in charge of importation, growing the poppies, making the drug, and getting it here. Then organized crime takes it from there and then deals it down to the street gangs, which are the ones that are killing everybody in Chicago, New York, and L.A. Those are drug street gangs doing that murder.
Right.
Again, federal law enforcement, you know, they need to read my book and wise up a little bit.
So we hear about, you know, 9 people killed in Chicago over the weekend and 41 people shot. And we always just think of it, and it's always kind of described as just random shootings. Just, oh, there's a little girl sitting in her car and she got shot, and this other guy just got shot. And you sort of think about it, is it that random? Could that many people just randomly be shooting each other in the streets of Chicago or L.A. or New York? Just random shootings? Because it's always described as just random gun violence.
Yeah, because they don't want to tell you the truth. That these African-American drug gangs in Chicago, all right, they war. Just like the mafia used to war. Mafia doesn't do that anymore, okay? They war for territory, for turf, for perceived slights, for disrespect, whatever it may be. These dealers have kids, all right? They take kids in the car, and when they get whacked, the kids get whacked, and the wife gets whacked, or the girlfriend. This isn't people walking out of their home saying, I'm going to murder somebody today. This is gang-related, all right? And the authorities, they have to know it, but they don't do anything about it. And there are a lot of political reasons why.
Is it safe to say that, because we always do, so we kind of do two things. We go random people shooting each other in the streets of Chicago. And then at some point they distill it down and they go, well, these are gangbangers. But they don't really say what the business is of the gangbangers. They're just gangbangers who shoot each other. But these guys are dealing in narcotics. That's why they're shooting each other. I mean, generally.
That's the only business that gangs have. Unless you're MS-13 Salvadorans, they shake down other Salvadorans. I mean, that's what they do. That's the low on the chain. But the drug gangs operating with the approval of the mob, they're selling fentanyl and heroin and cocaine and methamphetamine. That's where the money is. Money's not in sports gambling anymore. Everybody's legalizing that. It's not in pot. That's not where the big money is. It's hard drugs where the big money is.
Yeah, I don't think people understand how adaptable these cartels are. I tell everyone the second we made pot legal, they stopped growing pot and went right to fentanyl. Like they...
Right.
That's what they do. They just adapt and overcome. And they're, you know, they're, you can call them whatever you want, but they do understand business at a very basic level, which is, you know, supply and demand. And it's amazing how, it's also kind of amazing how flexible they are, or how they're able to switch from this to, you know, you go from pot to step up with human trafficking, or step up with fentanyl, or step up with heroin or cocaine. Like they really seem, you know, a Blockbuster couldn't do that. You know, they, like other businesses aren't that fluid. So let's jump around in time a little bit. I know you were teasing, on Prager that, you have the full Jimmy Hoffa story. I don't know if anyone else has the full Jimmy Hoffa story. I've not heard it. Last I checked, we're still trying to figure out where he was buried. How did you come upon that information?
We got it from the family of Hoffa. And we take you minute by minute on the day he dies, right through what happened. So people say, well, where's Jimmy Hoffa buried? He's not buried. They chop them up into little pieces, all right? And when you're in little pieces, Corolla, you don't need a funeral. It's just like you're gone, okay? But he was killed north of Detroit, all right? that Irishman movie by Scorsese, that's bull. Okay. The guy who wrote it had lung cancer. He was dying. He needed money. He basically said to the publisher, I killed him. So give me a big contract for the book, which he gave to his children. And he wrote whatever he wanted to write. He didn't do it. Okay. We have right in there pretty much exactly what happened. I don't think it's going to be challenged by anybody. We spent a lot of time on that Hoffa hit.
And also the mob was tied up with unions, and I guess people know the Hoffa.
Well, it was more
story.
Than that, though. Go. Hoffa, when he got out of prison, wanted to then run the Teamsters Union again. The mob didn't want that. They had a guy in there, Fitzsimmons, who was doing everything they said. So the mob makes its money off unions by taking pension money. Billions of dollars in pension money and building Las Vegas. That's how Vegas was built, with union pension money. And it's a loan. They loan, okay? So the mob didn't want Hoffa back in because Hoffa was just a big mouth. He attracted a lot of attention, a lot of federal wiretaps on him. But Hoffa wanted it. And Hoffa basically said to the mob, and this is in Killing my book, you give me that back or I'm going to go tell the government what you're really up to. Back. That was the end of Jimmy Hoffa.
Hmm. And let's talk Vegas, by the way. Killing the Mob, the fight against organized crime in America. It's available now. So you hear about the Bugsy Siegel Vegas thing. Tell us about the formation of Vegas.
Okay. So Lucky Luciano was deported right after World War II. And he went to Italy where he didn't want to be. We got a really interesting photograph of him in Naples of Luciano. So Luciano flies to Cuba, where the mob pretty much ran that government, the Batista government. You'll remember the scene in Godfather II where Castro comes in. He wins in 1959. This was way before that. Okay. So Luciano sets up in the Hotel Nacional in Havana, and all the mob guys come in. All right, to meet with Luciano, all the Italian mafia chieftains. And they decide to build Las Vegas. So we got Havana, it's working great, but we'd make a lot more money if we had an American city. So we're going to put Bugsy Siegel.
Is this 1946 or?
Yeah, a little bit later than that, 48, 49.
Okay.
So Meyer Lansky, the Jewish New York gangster who was living in Miami, he's the money man. His best bud is Bugsy Siegel. Sends Bugsy out to build a Flamingo Hotel, first hotel. All right? Bribe everybody in Nevada, get the gambling licenses. They're going. Bugsy blows it. Bugsy cost overruns all over the place, okay? And is doing crazy things because he's involved with Virginia Hill. And if you saw the Beatty movie, Beatty had about 10% of it, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, Meyer Lansky signs off to kill Bugsy Siegel because he's out of control. And the mob's not getting the money back on the investment they want. Siegel gets wiped out in L.A. We take you through that second by second. Okay? He gets hit in L.A. But the mob retains all of its contacts in Vegas and basically takes that town over. In addition, the mob buys up all the nightclubs in the major cities. So if you were an entertainer a la Frank Sinatra or Tony Bennett or the Rockers, Bobby Rydell or any of these guys, you had a deal with organized crime if you wanted to play in the nightclubs and if you wanted to get your record played on a radio. The mob controlled the movie industry, the rock industry, the nightclub industry, everything. It's unbelievable power. Meantime, there wasn't one federal agency investigating it. For 16 years, they ran wild. And that's the heart of Killing the Mob.
What happened in Cuba vis-a-vis the mob? How did that?
Well, they bought Batista. Batista was a dictator.
Right.
So Batista ran Cuba. They bought him. All right. And Batista said, fine, you can own all the hotels. We'll have legalized gambling and prostitution. You can run it all. Just give me my payment every month, which was millions of dollars. So Castro knew this, and most of the people in Cuba knew it because it wasn't trickling down to the folks. They were poor, and they're looking at all these guys, all these American mobsters and everybody in the casinos. They don't have enough to eat. So it was easy for Castro, not easy, but it was very, very favorable to a communist guerrilla. And Castro didn't say he was communist. He said, I'm getting rid of the corrupt Batista and the mob. I'm kicking them all out, which Castro did.
We need to hear a little word from our good friends over at Signal Wire. Signal Wire, what innovation, powering the future of remote business communications. The investment division of a Fortune 500 company needed to capture the energy of the trading floor while the team was working remotely, so they chose SignalWire. SignalWire mimics the in-person experience with always available video rooms that can be joined with just one click, allowing quick, informal, unscheduled conversations to help teams feel connected. Smart businesses are using SignalWire to future-proof their hybrid and remote communications. Let me give you a couple of examples here. The American Cancer Society exceeded fundraising goals when they had to take their annual gala virtual due to the COVID situation. SignalWire helped them create an amazing experience. Precision Diagnostics chose SignalWire for their global sales kickoff to create a virtual experience instead of everyone watching a boring PowerPoint webinar. It is one of the most incredible pieces of technology I've ever experienced at SignalWire. Right, Dawson?
Sign up today at SignalWire.com with code ADAM for a risk-free 30-day evaluation. And for a limited time, SignalWire will buy lunch for your first team meeting. That's SignalWire.com. And remember to use code ADAM. Go to SignalWire.com today for terms and conditions.
All right. Bill O'Reilly is with us, Killing the Mob. I find this endlessly fascinating. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back to talk all things mob right after this. Hey, Geico, do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there, owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle? Bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.
You will get Ace Man's favorites. You will get awesome booze for $25 shipped to you. You better believe it. You can get Adam's monthly nut. You should get Adam's monthly nut. You should get Adam's monthly nut. There's some real cool crap. You know that you want that.
You heard Dick. A new month of Adam's Monthly Nut has arrived. April will feature Righteous Felon Beef Jerky with flavors like Chipotle Guevara and Habanero Escobar. Expand laces, because who doesn't want to turn every shoe into a slip-on? At least sometimes. You'll also get a copy of Daddy Stop Talking and a bottle of your choice. Prep your mail's box, because Adam's Monthly Nut is on its way.
Back with Bill O'Reilly, Killing the Mob, the fight against organized crime in America. Like I said, the series, the Killing series, it's endlessly fascinating. And you really kind of, you know, it's usually kind of laborious to become an expert in something, because it means you have to study a bunch of boring crap and then you become an expert at it. But you do these killing books and you will know more than anybody at your next cocktail party about any of the subjects that these books cover, and they're entertaining. So and I would argue it's probably a lot more ease, the information is a lot more digestible when it's being presented in a entertaining way. So check out the series. So the mob, we've been kind of jumping all over the timeline. Back to Sonny Liston, because I love boxing. They paid him out to take a dive in the second fight as well?
Yes. And the fight in Boston and Massachusetts knew that Liston threw the first fight. So they wouldn't license him to fight Muhammad Ali the second time in a Boston Garden. That's where the fight was supposed to take place. So they had to go up to Lewiston, Maine, in a college hockey rink. The only people that would license the fight, because the states knew that organized crime controlled Liston. So they wouldn't give him the license. That's how it wound up, the second fight, up there in Maine in the middle of nowhere.
Wow, yeah. I mean, obviously, you think about a fight, think about Vegas, think about, you know, New York City, Staples Center, whatever. You wouldn't think about a college hockey rink in Maine. That's
right.
Crazy.
Boston Garden, that was 17,000. The college hockey rink was 2,800.
So, right. A lot of concessions, a lot of tickets left on the table. So Sonny never copped to it, but his wife did. Is that correct?
Yes, correct. And Sonny Liston did not die because he was a drug addict. That's the story, cover story. He died of an overdose of heroin. They gave him a hot shot, Liston.
The mob did.
Yeah, because they knew that his wife was yapping and that the people were starting to look at this. And it's the same thing with Hoffa. If you get on the wrong side of the mob, you're going to, Machiavelli once said, Carolla, and you should memorize this. If you're going to dine with the devil, you bring a long spoon. You get close to these people, they're going to hurt you. It's just a matter of when, not if. None of the characters that we talk about in Killing the Mob, none of them come out in the end well. All of them get it.
Sonny, how long after he retired did he overdose or was he given the hot shot?
I don't have the exact date off the top of my head. It was a while. And right. He was a greeter in Las Vegas.
Right.
The mob gave him a job in Las Vegas.
Right.
All right. But stuff was happening and they didn't want him. You know, I don't know whether he was asking for more money. I don't know. Just know.
Right, well, basically, here's how the mob works. They either need you or they don't need
they
you.
Don't.
And if they don't need you, then you're a liability because you have information and there's no reason why you need to be walking around if they don't need you. Now, if you don't think twice about killing somebody and the mob doesn't think twice about killing someone, then why would you let a bunch of liabilities walk around? I mean, the only thing that would stop that is your own conscience or your own, you know, relationship with Jesus Christ or something. But if you don't have
a lot of that going on, right?
Right.
But here's the great, here's my favorite story in Killing the Mob. And I can't tell you the whole story, Carolla, but I can set it up for you. You remember I Love Lucy. I think you did a guest shot for that program at one time.
I played
young Ricky's
drum instructor. So. Yes, back in 1957.
I thought so. Yes. So I Love Lucy is huge in the 1950s. You remember the husband, what his name was?
Desi Arnaz.
So Desi Lucy. Okay, I think that's politically incorrect, but it's your show, so I can get away with it. So Desi Arnaz becomes a very, very powerful TV producer. He runs Desi Lu Productions in L.A.
Right.
Do you know what the big hit was from Desi Lu?
I'm going to say The Untouchables.
Yes, because you heard it on Prager.
That's right.
The Untouchables. And you remember Robert Stack, Elliot Ness, he's chasing down all the Italian mobsters.
Right.
So Sam Giancana, at one time the most powerful mobster in the country, who helped get JFK elected, all right, he sends through Sidney Korshak, who ran the entertainment industry for the mob, a note to Desi Arnaz saying, we don't like this show. You ought to make some of the villains other ethnicities. I don't think Sam used ethnicities, but you get it. Whereupon Desi Arnaz wrote a wise guy note back to Giancana and said, what do you want me to make them, Jews?
Right.
Giancana puts a contract out on him, hires the assassin. We name the assassin, okay? The assassin didn't want to do it. because he had just gotten out of the penitentiary. But he had to do it. Mm-hmm. And then it was this close to Desi Arnaz in a bullet in the head. But I'm not going to tell you anymore because I didn't know any of this. And Dugard found it when we were researching Giancana, whose girlfriend was Phyllis McGuire, who then got involved with Dan Rowan. Remember?
Oh, Rowan Latin? Martin. Yeah.
Yeah. It's endlessly fascinating what we have written in Killing the Mob. It just every powerful person had to come across this organized crime apparatus in the 50s and 60s.
What? Is there any Marilyn Monroe stuff in there? Is there any John Kennedy stuff in there?
And a lot of Kennedy stuff, because Giancana's girlfriend, Judith Exner, was one of Kennedy's paramours. So we have all that. The Monroe stuff goes through Frank Sinatra, who was vile. I'm sorry. I know he's a great performer and singer. Vile human being. He paraded Marilyn Monroe out a few times, one of them in Lake Tahoe, in front of his mob friends. Sinatra wanted to be a made man, all right? He wanted to be in the mafia. It wasn't like they dragged him in. Like most of the rockers, they got dragged in. They didn't want it, okay? Sinatra wanted it. And Marilyn got dragged in by him. But there wasn't any follow through. She was just used in ways you can imagine.
What was the Sinatra? I mean, why do you say he was so vile?
Came from a very heavily Italian home in New Jersey. Got a contract early on with a big band leader. Wanted to break the contract, went to his local mafioso, who then went to higher ups, and Sinatra got out of the contract. Then they had a hook into Sinatra, because remember, the mob owned all the nightclubs, Latin Quarter, all the big clubs in New York, Copacabana, all right? And so Frank signed contracts with organized crime to appear. But he became very friendly with the mob leaders, and he'd do private concerts, first communions. He'd show up in Miami at the Fontainebleau, owned by the mob, all right, to perform, all of that. And Sinatra relished this because he could walk around as a tough guy. You want to get me? Well, you're going to have to deal with Sam in Chicago, that kind of stuff. He loved that. So Sinatra, of them all, was all in with organized crime.
Completely random question, but since you were talking about the mob and their control over these bands, the Bobby Fuller Four, I think the band that sung I Fought the Law and the Law Won, Bobby Fuller was killed mysteriously very young, and it was always alleged he was dating a mob girlfriend or a mobster's girlfriend, and I think they had him whacked, but I don't know if you've ever heard that story.
I haven't, but that's never a good strategy, just for people who are watching.
Well, I'm going to tell my son when I get home, yeah. Listen.
No, here's the list, okay? Mob girlfriends? No. We tell stories about Bobby Rydell, mm-hmm. Who's literal godfather was Angelo Bruno, the mob boss in Philadelphia. Okay. Tommy James and the Shondells, you remember?
Sure.
Mob took
Crimson and Clover, I think, was their song.
Mob took money from them. And if you wanted to record, okay, the mob guy was put on the writing of the song, even though I had nothing to do with it. So royalties would flow. The most fascinating story was Berry Gordy, Motown, okay? So the mob wanted control over Motown because it was huge in the 60s.
Right.
Gordy didn't sign it over. And it was alleged that he did, but he didn't. We investigated that. We couldn't find any association between Berry Gordy and these guys in a formal basis where they were skimming off Motown. I don't know how to this day Berry Gordy got away with that, because everybody else had to pay, but he somehow did not. It's a fascinating story. He's still alive, as you know. I hope he tells it someday.
What did the mob have to do with Hollywood?
That is one of the greatest stories ever. So the gangsters loved the movies, all right? They loved Cagney and White Heat and all that. They loved it. So when Los Angeles started to really percolate the movies out after World War II, the mob sent a guy named Sidney Korshak to L.A. Korshak was a lawyer, not a mob guy, but he was a liaison between Giancana and the New York families with the Hollywood moguls. What Sidney would do would basically say to the guys running the studios, all right, Warner Brothers, Paramount, all the big studios, you want your movie made? We need to get a piece. Or the sound guys and the lighting guys, they're not coming. The camera guys aren't showing up.
So it was a union.
You have a lot of labor trouble.
It's like a union thing.
Right.
Right.
So at one point, Sidney Korshak was actually casting movies and telling these guys, I think you're going to make this movie and Frank's going to be in it. Now, The Godfather dealt with that a little bit. And it's true. Korshak was the most powerful person in the movie industry. He never was arrested. They never got him. They tried, but they never got him. And he was the fixer.
From what year to what year, approximately?
46 to 63, 64. See, once Bobby Kennedy launched at organized crime and went after Hoffa and the unions and did the hearings and did all that, much harder. Became much harder because the mob then had the curtain pulled back on it. All right? That's when Puzo wrote his book and things started to get out. Before then, Hoover wouldn't investigate them at all. They had no worries about law enforcement.
Well, what lesson can we learn? Because I feel like we're in this time where we're sort of closing an eye to what's going on. There's stuff, you know, I am pretty well informed on a lot of the stuff that's going on in Mexico and China's involvement and setting up labs there to make fentanyl and all that kind of stuff. And it just seems like we're just sitting back and watching it. But it also seems like when we're motivated, when Bobby Kennedy was motivated and said, I'm going to go after these guys, he put a pretty big dent in the racket. And, you know, I feel like there's a version of this for gangs or for homeless or for whatever. When we really make a concerted effort and go after or try to fix something, we can be pretty effective. Why aren't we more motivated to fix this? And what could we do to fix it currently?
Because narcotics adversely affects mostly middle class, working class, and poor, the wealthy fat cats don't care. And this is a non-ideological statement I'm making to you, Carolla. By saying that heroin dealing was a non-violent crime, as President Obama did, and that fentanyl, meth, cocaine, and heroin dealers don't deserve long prison sentences, they open the floodgates. So now, in Oregon, you can deal hard drugs. They're not going to arrest you. In New York, heroin dealers, I mean, selling to 16-year-olds, no bail. So it's getting so bad that it would take a strong man, and I mean that literally, not a strong man, Arnold, a strong man, almost a dictator, to go in and dissemble this industry, which makes billions of dollars. And you're absolutely right. China knows this, and China knows how corrosive the opioid epidemic is. So China is trying to replace Mexico in the fentanyl production because they can make it cheaper, faster, but it's harder for the Chinese to get it in here than it is the Mexicans. So that's what the Chinese are trying to figure out now. But there isn't anybody in government that I know of that has any will to solve this drug problem. ever. They won't do it.
Well,
and it's like the homeless in California. What do you think is behind that?
Well,
it's all drugs.
Of course, it's all drugs. But there's also a bizarre politicized language that's attached to it, which is they were like the formerly housed or are unhoused guests, or God forbid you try to bring up the addiction or the mental situations, and you get shouted down. They try to do this thing where the face of homelessness are, this is a mother of three who lost her job at the factory and now has to sleep in the park. There's something about it that's so political. My friend, Dr. Drew, was just, someone on the L.A. City Council said, let's get Dr. Drew in on this and let's see if we can use his expertise. And they voted him out. They would not confirm him for free, essentially, something that's never done. They wouldn't confirm him. They wanted him. They didn't want him agitating over there with ideas or thoughts or talking about addiction. So there's something going on, and I don't know what it is. There's homeless everywhere. It's clear that it's all addiction. They won't call it addiction. They just keep talking about these make-believe stories of people who lost their job and now they sleep on the sidewalk. They don't talk about mental illness. They don't talk about addiction. And if anyone wants to come in who does know about addiction, who does want to address the problem, they won't give them a seat at the table.
That's because the far-left progressives see addicted people as marginalized, as victims, and to some extent they are. I don't want to be callous about this, but they're not being held responsible for what they do after they become addicted. Because it's not their fault, say the progressives, it's society's fault. So the white supremacist society in America has denied these people the avenue to have a productive life so that they have to take fentanyl and heroin. Well, they're denied by the white power structure. That is the root of all of this, Carolla.
It is the opposite of tackling a problem. They literally sit back, watch the problem grow year in and year out. And I know as a native, you know, homelessness used to be contained to Skid Row and parts of downtown L.A. It was never all over the West Side, beach cities. My old city, I grew up in North Hollywood, Studio City, the San Fernando Valley. There was no such thing as homelessness in the San Fernando Valley. Now it's ubiquitous in the San Fernando Valley. So in the face of this problem that just keeps getting worse month in and month out, they literally don't do a thing. They just sit back and watch it. And I have no idea what the plan is. And they do not offer a plan. They always say we need
There's
more
no
money.
Plan.
They want more
There's
money
no
from
plan.
The federal government. But there is no plan.
Because, look, the only solution to this problem is forced rehabilitation. I did my thesis on this at Harvard. I went to Singapore. I saw what they did. Mandatory rehabilitation. You take the market away. That's the only solution. And all these pinheads that go, oh, rehab. We have rehab. You have to understand that many, perhaps most, drug-addicted people don't want rehab. They like getting high. They like no responsibility, no job, nothing but getting high. They're not going to rehab. And rehab is hard. It takes a tremendous amount of willpower. Most people don't want to do it. So there is a solution, but as I said, very tough. You incarcerate people who sell poison for a long period of time. Doesn't matter what color they are, okay? And if you are a drug addicted person, you have to go to rehab. Have to. Takes the market away. And 70% of all child abuse and neglect in America is caused by substance abusers. This is not a victimless crime. And if you legalize it, It's not going to make it easier on those children. They're still going to be abused and neglected by intoxicated parents. That's it.
As we wind down here, we'll move back toward the mob. So the mob now in numbers is much smaller, but they franchised, right?
Yes.
So they have all the gangs in the inner cities as sort of franchisees, but the actual number of mobsters is probably quite a bit lower than it was in the heyday.
But they're still ultra violent. You don't make your payment to the mobster that's controlling your area of New York City. You don't make that payment, they'll make an example of you.
Are they out? Are they out completely of the entertainment world, of the nightclub world, of that world?
Much harder.
Is it pretty much harder. Drugs now? Is that 90% of the game? I know there's some human trafficking on the cartel side of the border,
The other stuff is chump change. They still run the bookies, the numbers, rackets, but that's nothing. The narcotics are billions of dollars. So that's where all the mob's energy is concentrated. But they're fierce and they're brutal and they have no ethos. They will do anything. And everybody knows that. The Mexican cartels fear the United States organized crime people. That's why the cartels are not here. Because if they come here, they know they won't be here long. And I mean on the planet.
The mob is... Now, when was the transition into narcotics? Because at least it's fabled in movies that they had that ethos. Like they said, we'll do this, but we won't do that. We'll never get into the narcotics. It's dirty. That's not our game. What year, what period did they switch to that game?
About 1958, Vito Genovese, he did it. The worst of the worst, the most evil individual outside of Nazis and Pol Pot and Mao Zedong, Vito Genovese, drove the mob into the narcotics traffic. And Lucky Luciano, he didn't really want it because he knew that was so intense that it would wipe out the other industries the mob was doing, which absolutely happened. But Genovese is the guy that brought that over in the mid to late 50s. And then it exploded in the sex, drugs, and rock and roll era, the Vietnam era. Then it went boop like that.
Where do you think we are now in terms of the drugs, the mob, the culture? Let me just bring up heavyweights. There's heydays for heavyweights. Everyone knows the mid-70s, the early 70s, Ali and Joe Frazier and Foreman came along and all these great. And then people look to the early 80s and there are a bunch of no-name heavyweights that nobody can remember. Ronaldo Nehemiah, Ronaldo Snipes. I can't remember. One was a sprinter. One was guys you've never really, Witherspoon and just kind of guys you hadn't really... The Spinks brothers, guys you hadn't really heard of who weren't perennial Hall of Famers. And so there's good eras for the heavyweights, bad eras for the heavyweights. Where are we now with drugs and the mob?
They make more money on narcotics than ever before.
That's where we are.
The American society, the media, very permissive society, as you know. Media does not condemn it. No more Nancy Reagan, just say no. The progressive left says victimless crime. Not you want to sell heroin, not your fault, because one of your ancestors was enslaved. So I know you have to sell heroin to make a living now because the white supremacists won't let you make a living any other way. So all of that confluence of garbage, as I coined that term, confluence of garbage, has really benefited organized criminals who are importing this stuff in record amounts, and it's cheap. It's cheap. I mean, you want fentanyl and heroin, that you can, a kid can buy it.
Yeah.
And
it's
horrible.
Well, I would, it's interesting. I was talking to someone earlier today. I said, you know, when I was young, if you wanted a big TV set, that was a big ticket item. Now you can get a 52-inch TV for $250. Like, it's cheaper. Cars. I said, the technology that's in cars today, $20,000 cars filled with as much technology as a Rolls Royce has. Like, it's, we're just making stuff faster and cheaper. And I guess fentanyl would sort of follow along with that. The technology, the innovation, the chemistry, the science, just, it's cheap now. When I,
you take it, you're going to die.
When I was,
you take fentanyl, I think there's an important point, Adam.
Yes.
For everybody watching, because this is going to go wide. You know that this interview will.
Sure.
You take fentanyl, you're going to die.
Yeah.
So you want to kill yourself? Okay. But you do that, then you're in that zone. Go ahead.
The book, Killing the Mob, The Fight Against Organized Crime in America, it's available now on Amazon. And I, like I said, I recommend all of the books, now 10 to be exact, and in the Killing series, because you will be an expert at whatever the subject is and entertain, and the No Spin News you can listen to at 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific on First TV. Bill, always a pleasure and always so informative.
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate it. I'm glad you're doing well. And let's talk again soon. Thanks again.
Please. Bill O'Reilly, we'll take a quick listen to our friends over at Apartments.com. Apartments.com. Most people know that Apartments.com is the most popular place to find a place. That's because Apartments.com has the most rental listings and most ways to find them, thanks to some of the most powerful tools like 3D virtual tours. So you're most likely to find your most right place, which most everyone would agree is good news, unless you're weird and prefer to have less than most. Make the most obvious move for your next move and use Apartments.com, the most popular place to find a place. All right, Bill O'Reilly, very interesting cat. Also, Jam in the Van will be performing out here in Los Angeles May 22nd. Golden, Colorado's coming up June 18th, 19th. Royal Oak, Michigan, September 10th. And Kansas City, September 11th. Go to amcrola.com. Get all the live dates. No Safe Spaces, available now on Prime Video, if you like. Crank Yankers, new season premieres tonight, 10:30, Comedy Central. Until next time, Adam Carolla for Gina Gradball, Brian, and Bill O'Reilly saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Catch Gina Grad with Teresa Strasser on Easy Listening, the podcast. And Bald Brian on the Film Vault, plus me, Kaylin, Gary, Fondelier, and Loxamana on a little thing we call the water cooler. For tickets to see Adam live, books, movies, and more, go to adamcarolla.com.
Hey, Geico, do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there. Owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle? Bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.
Hey, movie lovers. Who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts. Ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.